Good afternoon, everyone. That's the strongest gavel hit I have ever done before. I apologize. I think I needed that. I'm a little tired, so I'm just waking everybody up. I call this meeting of the House Tribal Affairs Committee to order. It is 3:31 p.m., Monday, February 5th, 2024, in Capitol Room 106. Members present are Representative Vance, Representative Allard, Representative Carrick, and myself, Chair McCormick. Please, as always, take this time to silence your cell phone and make sure that they are put on silent for the duration of the meeting. Before we begin, I would like to thank Annie Goodenough, the House Tribal Affairs Committee Secretary from Records, and Talia Ames from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee today. Today we are joined by Tammy Truitt-Drew, Executive Director of the Alaska Native Women's Resource Center. Thank you for returning. Rick A. Hoskins-Garcia, Co-Director of Law and Policy from the Alaska Native Women's Resource Center. Alex Cleghorn, Chief Operating Officer of the Alaska Native Justice Center. Megan Sigvana Topcock, Staff Attorney to Kowarik. Today's presentation, we will speak about the unique legal landscape of Alaska, the challenges that many regions, including District 38, the region that I represent, deal with every day, and the efforts of tribes to improve justice and public safety within our communities. As always, just for the purpose of time, we will hold all questions until the presentation is over. And I just want to note, I know a lot of our members today had a conflicting meeting with resources, so unfortunately they weren't able to make it. I mentioned on the floor, if other representatives come, I invited them to come sit at the table and ask questions as well. So thank you everyone again for being here. Mr. Haskins, if you're, excuse me, Haskins-Garcia, if you're ready, please put your name on the record and begin your presentation.
Yes. Good evening. My name is Rick Haskins-Garcia. Thank you, Chair McCormick and members of the committee. We really appreciate this opportunity to share some time with you today. As I mentioned, my name is Rick Haskins-Garcia. I currently serve as the co-director of law and policy for the Alaska Native Women's Resource Center, which is a Fairbanks-based organization that's focused on supporting tribes through resources to end domestic violence and gender-based violence in our tribal communities. I also work hand-in-hand with a lot of tribes helping to support and build the tribal justice systems, which is what we're going to talk about today. As far as a presentation roadmap, there are a couple points that we're hoping that we can discuss with everyone today. First is talking about Alaska's documented danger for Alaska Native women, talking about our Alaska tribal justice systems, the history of our tribal justice systems, and changes in how the state of Alaska has recognized tribal authority and jurisdiction. And we're going to move on to talk about enforcement of tribal court orders, recent changes in law, current challenges and updates in federal law, and then round out our presentation today talking about the Violence Against Women Act and the 2022 reauthorization. I wanted to start out today's presentation talking about the problem that we're experiencing in Alaska, and that really deals with homicide of Alaska Native and American Indian women. The problem is that domestic violence and related homicides in Alaska continues to remain a real problem. The Violence Policy Center, which is a national educational organization that works for a safer America through research, analysis, and advocacy, published a report where they researched and chronicled the homicide rate of female victims killed by male offenders. And what they found was that Alaska is experiencing a prolonged epidemic of deadly violence against women. When we take 2020, for example, Alaska had the highest homicide rate in the United States for female victims killed by their male offenders in a single victim, single offender incident for the seventh year in a row. And throughout the past 10 years, Alaska has ranked either first or second in the nation in the rate of women killed by men for 10 years in a row. And so on the screen there, you see the rate of the United States rate is located and it's identified in blue. And as we can see, the rates of Alaska, at least since 2008, continue to rise. We see a slight decline in 2020. But again, Alaska is ranked first in the number of statistics that we wished we weren't ranked first in. When we talk about American Indian and Alaska Native women, they are disproportionately impacted by deadly violence against women in Alaska. And we've heard a lot throughout this week about the violence committed specifically against Alaska Native American Indian women. But the rate is Alaska Native women killed by men in Alaska is 12.63 per 100,000 women, which is astonishingly more than 3.5 times the rate for all women in Alaska. And we would compare that to the rate of women across the United States and in Alaska, it's 10 times the rate for white women in Alaska. And so this crisis of violence against Alaska Native women in Alaska, it should be a top priority for each of us here in all the work that we do, but it continues to remain a problem for Alaska. The National Institute of Justice did a study, and I know that we've talked about some of these statistics this week, but what they found was that more than 4 in 5 Alaska, American Indian Alaska Native women, or about 85%, have experienced violence in their lifetimes. Of that 85%, 56% have experienced sexual violence, 56% have experienced physical violence by an intimate partner, almost 50% have experienced stalking, and 67% have experienced psychological aggression by an intimate partner. So what the National Institute of Justice found, they found that over 1.5 million American Indian and Alaska Native women have experienced violence in their lifetime. And it's important to remember that this study was done in the mid-2018s. So we know that that number has increased since then. We're now in 2024. And again, the crisis of violence against Alaska Native American Indian women in this state remains a crisis to be addressed. And some of the problem stems from a 1978 Supreme Court case, the Oliphant versus Suquamish Indian Tribe. And that was, it grew out of the Suquamish tribe's prosecution of two non-Indian residents on their reservation. One resident was charged with assaulting a tribal officer and resisting arrest, and the other was charged with recklessly endangering another person and injuring tribal property after a high-speed race on reservation lands. The two defendants, who again were non-Native, were charged in tribal courts, and they sought habeas release and argued that the tribe lacked criminal jurisdiction over non-Indians such as themselves. This went up through the federal district courts in Washington, and each of the lower courts found that their arguments lacked merit, that the Indian tribes did have jurisdiction over non-Native offenders who were committing crimes on reservation-based lands. It got appealed to the United States Supreme Court. And in 1978, the Supreme Court of the United States ruled that the non-Indian defendants, that the Indian tribe lacked jurisdiction over non-Indian defendants and that the tribe did not have jurisdiction. And so if we think about federal Indian law from the time the United States became the country up until 1978, Alaska Native American Indian tribes always had jurisdiction over crimes that occurred on their lands. And so this was a really large shift in federal Indian law. And what we see from 1978 until at least 1994, when the first Violence Against Women Act was passed, is that if our state governments, if our federal governments were not prosecuting crimes against non-Indians committing crimes on reservation-based lands or Indian lands, that they were largely going unpunished. Ever since that Supreme Court's 1978 decision, tribes have really been powerless to exercise criminal jurisdiction over non-Indian defendants. And some of my colleagues later will be talking about some recent changes in federal law that will allow for Alaska Native tribes to exert certain criminal jurisdiction over certain crimes. But largely, again, if our state governments and our federal governments were not picking up these crimes, it was emboldening these non-Indian defendants that were committing these crimes, and they were, again, largely going unpunished. And so we saw that there was a gap in law enforcement. There were a gap against crimes committed in Indian country. It resulted in many of our Indian survivors, our Indian families, our Indian communities being left since powerless and left without justice and without healing. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to my executive director, Tammy Trichard. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Haskins Garcia. And Ms. Drew, if you would just state your name for the record and continue the presentation.
So for the record, Tammy Truitt Drew, and I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Native Women's Resource Center. Thank you. So we'll talk a little bit about the history of traditional kind of justice systems in Alaska, and I think it's important to understand that history, that we did have justice systems in place of for a manner of speaking that often people don't really recognize. This quote is from an elder from the Amonic area, a Yupik elder, and she's passed now. But we had been down there talking with many elders about what traditional law looked like in terms of how did the communities start to, well, for better, a lack of a better word, police our own people in our communities, because obviously we had to work together in order to survive, actually. So this is a quote from her, and that was, the men talked to that person, and the object was to retrain the man how to treat his wife, to show respect. If they were repeat abusers, if they didn't learn their lesson, then they'd be told to pack up like extra clothing, hunting gear, food, and told to go out into the wilderness and the tundra and survive the experience of living alone. When the men checked him, he was allowed to come back into the community and village and allowed to go back to his wife. Instead of being punished like they take to jail today and fined and all of that, they were not actual council members, but everybody, all men, were involved in the problem. So really it was based on values, the moral of that community, and how really we had to work together in a community, both for food and for shelter and for just the communal living of the survival in many of our where we lived, that were fairly, they were very bare, and the conditions, you know, for survival were very challenging sometimes. So I think that it's important to just add that. And then as we also talk to this about the traditional justice systems that were really prior to the Russian, basically, when the Russians came to Alaska on the coastal communities of Alaska, there was a already certain codes of behavior that we had to deal with. And basically, that a lot of the laws, I guess, if you would call them traditional laws or the rules of that community, were governed by family and clan relationships. There were very distinct protocol and relationships that created the safe space. Absolutely. So it was varied by culture, and it varied by region, and it varied by other things as well, in terms of even kinship. I think women at that point, I think, were uplifted and held sacred. They were the birth givers. They were the ones that continued life. They were the ones that continued the community, and they needed to be held and respected. And oftentimes, many of our communities were on a matrilineal type of a society, so that there was a lot of power in being a woman and just being able to have that sacredness and that place in the society of the community. And I think that the pieces that we oftentimes misunderstand, if you look at some of the values that tribes have and bring forward, it's really focused on accepting responsibility for bad behavior, or good behavior for that matter, but correcting wrongdoing and then restoring that balance, because that took us out of balance with that bad behavior. And there was also some restitution that also needed to be part of the act of making sure that you didn't insult and or you didn't take away the other family or clan's good feelings or responsibility, or there was just many, many ways of making that happen. I also, when we had the influence of the Russian contact, and I think this is important because what we're trying to establish here is why we are now coming forward with trying to establish the laws that now govern us in this country, but also how that tribal law is something that was before contact. And that's important when we start talking about sovereignty and the other conversations that'll happen after me. So there was eight decades of colonization. And again, I won't give you all the history lesson, but there was the domination of indigenous lands, and it was extractive industry. Furs, animals, that was why the Russians, this was such a rich place for the Russians to do trade. But what that influence did was that it also took away already those natural laws. And that put us in off balance, put our communities off balance, it put how we survived off balance, and then it continued that balance. Death, there was other destructions, wanting to act differently in terms of living not in our longhouses, if that was what part of that clan system, how we governed ourselves was changed. And then, of course, 1867, the United States purchased Alaska in the Treaty of Cession. Again, many people say that Alaska wasn't for sale. But again, that's a whole other conversation we probably won't have today. But the actual purchase included Alaska Native peoples without their consent. So again, another disruption or unbalance to what the systems were at this point. And the influence today from the U.S. 1867 to the present, basically the establishing the U.S. courts in the territory of Alaska, it represented a real loss of land, both land that was just traditional land that was never owned by the tribe, but that was their traditional place to exist, creating separate education systems for Alaska Native children, much to the detriment of many of those children. Which led to missionary and boarding schools, shifted land ownership from collective towards the individual. And that was the key, because the collective survived together, and the individual wasn't necessarily going to survive alone. Again, this influence also is the 1950 Alaska Territory Law. And this one piece right here, I'll let you read it for yourself, but that if you wanted to vote as an Alaska Native person, you had to have at least 5 white citizens of the United States who were permanent residents of Alaska to vouch for you. So in post-statehood, we also had the ability to... state magistrates were put forward to assume judicial roles. City councils formed in many villages. Many state resources went to support municipal forms of government. Again, those are all things that we know about and just as part of that history. But I think that the thing I'll leave you with is this quote, and this was stated earlier. Lisa Kedeljuice Lang, she is the Chief Justice for Tlingit Haida. And she talks about the colonization and how it severed Haida people's ties with ourselves, each other, our nation, the land, and the sea, reflected in the disrespect for and rates of domestic and sexual violence against our women and children. Our potlatches are our ways of upholding our societal rules, and these were outlawed in Alaska in the early 1900s and in Canada during the late 1800s. So I really, the basic idea here, though, is that inherent tribal sovereignty existed, exists, and still exists. It's something that we have that's a right. It's not something that was been given. And that's one of the, I think, really important statements that we would have to follow when we start talking about sovereignty, tribal justice systems, and the rest of that. Now, again, I'm not going to read that out loud. You can see that up there. And I think that I will turn it over to Alex shortly, but inherent tribal sovereignty is that there are 229 tribes in the state, totally sovereign tribes in the state. With that federal recognition that the U.S. government via the Bureau of Indian Affairs recognizes a government-to-government relationship with the tribes. And in that government-to-government relationship, recognizing the tribal governments, they're sovereign nations with the right of self-governance and administratively equivalent to U.S. federal government. So at this point, I'm going to turn that over to my colleagues, and thank you very much.
Thank you for your presentation.
Do you want this? Did I do it too soon?
No.
Okay. All right, I'll do that for you. Thank you.
Mr. Cleghorn, if you could please just state your name for the record and continue.
Chamai, good afternoon. My name is Alex Cleghorn, and I am the Chief Operating Officer of the Alaska Native Justice Center. I'll share a little bit about my background. I've been a lawyer for 20 years, mostly representing tribes and tribal organizations. I was born in Anchorage, grew up in Fairbanks, and my father's side of the family is from Kodiak. So I'm a tribal citizen at Woody Island. And I came home 10 years ago and started this work here after 10 years of doing tribal work in California. I did take a brief stay from working for tribes, and I was the Department of Law's first tribal liaison and an assistant attorney general for 2 years. So I share that because I think there is such opportunity for collaboration between the state and tribes. And I think that some of what I'm going to share today is going to highlight that. I've been tasked with trying to share some of the legal foundations in Alaska and also some of the most recent changes in federal law, as well as changes in the state's relationship with tribes. So what we have here that we've put up are direct quotes from either state of Alaska briefing or decisions about the status of tribes in Alaska. So in 1986, the belief in Alaska was that PL 280 somehow took away jurisdiction from Alaska tribes because Alaska tribes were so different that we didn't have the same kind of inherent tribal sovereignty as tribes in the lower 48. And you follow on from that with another decision that says even broader, there aren't even tribes in Alaska, and that we're so different in Alaska that we're not at all like tribes in the lower 48. And then we have an administrative order which says very clearly the state's position around expanding tribal government powers and the creation of Indian country in Alaska. And they share this not because it's the law now. The law is different now. But I share this because I think it's important not just to recognize the history, like has been shared by my colleagues, but the law and the state's position over time as it relates to tribes and tribal jurisdiction. But as I mentioned, that's not the law now. So the law now starts to change in 1999 with the Alaska Supreme Court that says, actually, there are tribes here, and tribes do have inherent sovereignty over core tribal matters, and that kind of sovereignty is tied to tribal citizenship, not land, right? So we have now one branch of the state government saying there's tribes here, they continue to exist, and they have sovereignty, even though there may not be reservations anymore. Next, we have the executive branch, the Alaska Attorney General's opinion on the legal status of tribes from 2017. Clearly articulates that there are tribes in Alaska, they are governments with inherent sovereignty. That same year, the Alaska Tribal Child Welfare Compact also recognizes that tribes and tribal organizations are existing and stepping forward to provide the kinds of services that had previously perhaps been provided by OCS. So that there is two branches of government. And then in 22, we have HB 123 signed by the governor that recognizes, again, federally recognized tribes. So we now have three branches of government in the state of Alaska that all agree there are federally recognized tribes here in Alaska that were not so different from tribes in the lower 48. I do want to talk about some of the things that are different here in Alaska and explain why they don't necessarily impact the jurisdiction and the responsibility of tribes to address violence in our communities. I think a lot of folks have heard that Alaska is a PL 280 state, right? Well, what does that mean? Public Law 280 was a federal act that transferred a lot of federal jurisdiction to the states. It said, states, you step forward, we're stepping back. And it's now your responsibility to provide public safety in Indian country. However, that's concurrent, and we're going to talk about what concurrent means, but it's concurrent with tribal jurisdiction. Now, what Public Law 280 did that continues to impact Alaska is that when the federal government took a step back and said, we're not responsible for public safety and justice in PL 280 states, the federal funding stopped. So you may have learned about the Alaska tribal health system and how we self-determine money. We take over federal funding and run those health programs ourselves. But that's reliant on there being federal funding to take over. There is no federal public safety and justice funding in PL 280 states for tribes to take over. So tribes are doing this work with special one-time funding and competitive grants, which has hampered our ability to step forward and do these things. PL 280 did not terminate tribes. It did not extinguish tribal sovereignty and did not take away tribal jurisdiction. Recently, the Federal Department of Justice reissued a memo that we'd been seeking for them to reissue for several years that reaffirms this position from the Department of Justice position, which is that PL 280 did not extinguish tribal sovereignty or take away jurisdiction. But that previous opinion had been written in 2000. So we've been asking them to update it. We have now a December 2022 memorandum from the Department of Justice specifically addressing this in Alaska. And happy to share that with you if it would be of interest. Well, but what about ANCSA, right? Didn't ANCSA handle this in some different way than the lower 48? Well, sure, it did. But it was about settling land claims in Alaska. It didn't terminate tribes, and it did not extinguish tribal sovereignty. Now, when it got rid of reservations, or all the reservations except for one, which is Metlakatla, that did impact territorial jurisdiction of tribes. There's not that Indian country land base anymore. But you go back to John V. Baker, which says, it's about the citizenship, not about the land. Tribes continue to have jurisdiction over their citizens. And then we'll turn to some of the federal law changes that more strongly recognize this in just a few slides. We did want to spend some time talking about the difference between concurrent and exclusive jurisdiction. So if PL 280 didn't extinguish tribes' jurisdiction, doesn't that somehow diminish the state's jurisdiction? No, not really. It's concurrent, right? You, a tribal citizen, could choose to go to tribal court or to state court, and each of those courts would have jurisdiction over that matter. This is not unique to Alaska. There are five other Public Law 280 states that have been addressing this issue for the 50 years since Public Law 280 was passed. Several states have developed agreements between state courts and tribal courts about how to handle this kind of concurrent jurisdiction so that you don't have races to the courthouse or you don't have the same court case happening in two different courthouses. So all concurrent means is more than one government can exercise jurisdiction. But what about exclusive jurisdiction? Well, tribes continue to have exclusive jurisdiction over some things. Most clearly, tribes have jurisdiction over determination over who our tribal members or citizens are. Those kinds of decisions are the right of a government, any government, to make, and exclusive to them. And that remains to be true in Alaska. So where are we now? Right? What's been happening on the ground? So there are numbers of tribal justice systems throughout Alaska that are attempting to address public safety, justice, and violence in our communities. They are often responding directly to violent concerns. They are hearing cases and making decisions, not just about public safety, but many decisions about child welfare cases. Oftentimes, the tribal system is the child welfare and justice system that is available. and they are making those decisions about placement of children. Here's a list of all the different kinds of cases. We know that tribal courts are hearing here in Alaska, and they run the gamut from adoptions to juvenile delinquency to vandalism. I mentioned at the beginning that I'd been doing tribal work in California before I came back home. And I served for a time as a tribal court judge in California. And the tribes that I worked there, I worked for there in California, were primarily addressing like large value contract cases and casino slip and fall and tort cases where there was large money on the table. But they weren't addressing child welfare cases. And then I came home and learned that primarily tribes here are addressing child welfare cases. And what I thought was interesting was that in California, where there were many resources available for tribal justice systems, they were addressing money cases, but they weren't ready yet to address child welfare cases. But here at home, tribes are stepping forward and handling some of the most difficult cases there can be, child welfare. So tribes are addressing these issues in a holistic way. And I think that Tammy laid the groundwork for this, but I do want to share one thing that I've learned along the way. And I learned this from Judge Abby Abernathy, who is the Yurok Tribal Court Supreme Court, Justice. She was the first California Native woman to pass the bar. And when she talks about the difference between tribal justice systems and Western justice systems, she explains that in tribal systems, there is the belief that we reach a better decision when people who know the family are involved in making the decision. And that in Western systems, we've made the decision that strangers make a better decision, that it's better to have people who don't know the family making decisions. And I think that that is a very nice encapsulation of the differences between the systems. And in a few slides, you'll get a chance to hear from Sig Topcock about some of the restorative justice initiatives that are happening throughout the state. Just to highlight again, some of the statistics that Rick shared at the beginning are up here again, but I think it's also important to recognize that it is well known that 1 in 3 villages have no public safety on the ground. And that when Attorney General Barr came to visit Alaska and saw what was happening, he was struck enough to declare a public safety emergency. So if, you know, the statistics tell part of the story, but his reaction, I think, also highlights part of what's happening here. And the situation we are in is calling for a different kind of response. I'm going to turn it back to Tammy here to talk a little bit more about how to support victims and survivors.
Thank you, Alex. So for the record, Tammy Truitt-Giroux. One of the reasons that we do this is because oftentimes folks don't understand that what Alex and Sig are going to talk about is about VAWA, which is Violence Against Women Act, right? And the fact is that one of the things that we found when that act moved through reauthorization several times is that Indian women and Alaska Native women were not being protected in ways that were really necessary, and there was nothing anywhere in law asking to try to do that. And so one of the things that this was done in terms of trying to support tribal justice systems and dealing with some of the issues in our own communities is that we needed to figure out a way to support victim survivors, but we also had to figure out a way to promote healing and justice, because justice doesn't work alone. I mean, if we continue to not have justice or have some way of holding people accountable for bad acts, then we have to figure out how are we going to heal and help victim survivors be supported in that system. So one of the ways is that, and then we have several things on the screen, is that, you know, support services and resources is a very minimal need when you have someone that goes through the justice system that is brave enough and courageous enough to come forward. Because oftentimes in domestic violence and sexual violence, it's so personal that it's very hard to have to come out there and share your experience and be out there in front of the public, right? So it's important that we can have advocacy or other resources at that justice level that also can support victim survivors. You know, I think that when we talk about interpersonal violence and sexual violence, there's a matter of shame. And people oftentimes don't know how to discuss that with you. People often, I've noted, you know, it's not because they're think you're bad, the person that's been victimized, it's that they have no words. What kind of words do we have to people that have suffered that kind of violence? And so one of the reasons that also we emphasize the supporting of victim survivors in promoting healing and justice is that they can work together. They can work together, and we hope that we can then help maybe promote healing and justice both for the perpetrator and for the victim survivor. So I think having a supportive system within justice and victim-centered is very, very important. And I think that tribes have been talking a lot about that when we talk about these changes that are happening in how we might look at justice within our tribal communities. So I'm going to turn it back over to...
I would just like to note for the record, I apologize and neglected to mention that at 3:51 p.m. we were joined by Representative Carpenter.
Through the chair, it's Alex Cleghorn back here at the mic. And I want to reinforce something that Tammy shared. In addition to the work that we do at the Alaska Native Justice Center, supporting tribes and tribal justice systems and highlighting ways that tribes can collaborate with the state, we provide direct legal services with integrated case management to victims and survivors of violent crime. And what we see is it is so important to be able to respond when somebody is finally able to step forward, share their story, and ask for help. Over the Christmas week, we had a skeleton crew in the office, but we had 5 protective orders that were requested and granted that week. So next, I get to turn back to talk about the law a bit more and about enforcement of tribal court orders. And I'm going to use words like full faith and credit and comity, and I'm going to talk about what those mean. But at the end of the day, what we're really talking about is helping to make sure that tribal court orders are effective on the ground and doing what they are designed to do. So first is enforcement within the tribe. And the tribe is responsible for that kind of enforcement. And we'll hear more from Megan Topcock in a few slides talking about sentencing circles and healing circles and other kinds of enforcement. What I would share here is my experience as a tribal court judge, both in California and Alaska, is that oftentimes one type of enforcement that we don't even consider in the Western system is an acknowledgement and an apology. Right? In the Western system, you don't admit anything. Right, and it's up to somebody else to prove it. And if it's a criminal case, prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, or lower standard for civil cases. And the ability to acknowledge and apologize for bad acts is not just healing for the community, but it can be healing for the person who caused the harm. And enforcement within the tribe can also include doing community service with an eye towards what is the community need, whether that be providing food, hauling honey buckets, whatever might be needed. But outside of the tribe, enforcement looks a little bit different. And we've got a couple federal laws that require what's called full faith and credit. And what this means is that it's presumptively adopted by the state court. Unless somebody objects and proves that the order was issued without jurisdiction, proper authority, without giving notice, or without allowing the parties to be heard. Right? So it's a presumption that this order is going to be given full faith and credit by the state court. And both the Indian Child Welfare Act and the Violence Against Women Act require full faith and credit for certain types of orders. The next kind of enforcement or recognition is called comity. And comity, it requires a bit more process. You've got to file it in state court, but it should be treated as a state court order unless there was some sort of fundamental unfairness. So why is it important that tribal court orders be recognized under state law? Well, remember, back to that concurrent jurisdiction in Public Law 280, there needs to be a mechanism for the state court system to recognize tribal court orders, including name change orders, child custody orders, and other types of orders. Oftentimes, these types of orders do require some legal process in the state system. And Alaska, the state court system has adopted several court rules that make this process a little smoother, both for child custody orders under ICWA and VAWA orders. So now we're going to turn to full faith and credit. The Indian Child Welfare Act was the first federal law that used this terminology of requiring full faith and credit to tribal court orders for child protection, adoption, guardianship, and some juvenile cases. The statute itself uses the term child custody proceeding, which sometimes causes some confusion. And folks think that it's about custody disputes between parents, but it is not. It is about child welfare cases, which include each one of those proceedings we've highlighted there. Now, for adoption, the tribal court order does not have to be registered. It can be sent directly to the State of Alaska BVS. For child protection orders, we do recommend that those orders are registered through the rules 24 and 25 and do go through some state process. The state has forms that are available to register those orders. And sometimes these are needed because some state law enforcement assistance is required in order to enforce child protection orders. The Violence Against Women Act also requires full faith and credit. And it is not just about states. It implicates more than state courts, but that's what we're going to focus on. So it highlights that the tribe can issue and enforce personal protection orders, that they're not required to register protection orders with the state for state law enforcement to serve and enforce them. Though we do recommend that tribes do send them to the local courthouse, there is a model cover sheet or a sample cover sheet that tribes can use to send those in. They're then stamped with a state number and forward to state law enforcement. And that eases enforcement to some extent. And I think that the reason that tribes do this, even though it's not strictly required under federal law, is because the safety of the victim or survivor is paramount. And you want less confusion about whether or not this order is going to be recognized and enforced should you need it. Back to comity recognition. What kinds of cases get comity recognition in state court? This is everything listed up there. Parent versus parent custody cases, divorces, name changes, some other civil cases may be eligible. And tribe does need to file, or the person seeking recognition, comedy recognition, does file a petition to register the court order. So there is more process. It's a petition in state court. It's not faxing the order to the state court for it to be stamped. Now I get to turn and talk about the recent law changes. So I think Tammy and Rick shared at the beginning, the Violence Against Women Act of 2013 was certainly paramount in addressing some of the public safety concerns in the lower 48. Alaska tribes were shut out in VAWA 2013. But in the most recent amendment, there was an entire chapter of VAWA 22 dedicated to Alaska and crafting a solution that is unique to our needs. So for the first time, there is now a territory defined where tribes' jurisdiction is recognized. It doesn't create Indian country, and it uses an Alaska-specific definition of village. And that definition of village actually is referring out to the definition of village that's in ANCSA. In the 10 years, nearly 10 years, between VAWA 2013 and VAWA 22, there were ongoing efforts and discussions about how to craft an Alaska-specific solution to this issue. And this is what was achieved. Right? It sidestepped the question of creating Indian country and instead focused on the public safety concerns and defining a territory within which tribes' jurisdiction is recognized and reaffirmed. The first main part of VAWA 22, section 813A, is a reaffirmation or an affirmation of Alaska tribes' authority over Native people within the village. Right? Many of us believed this to be true. I talked about the law change over the decades of litigation in Alaska. But there is still some ongoing confusion about this. And what VAWA 22 did was it stated very clearly that Alaska tribes have authority over Native people within the village. That includes criminal adjudicatory authority. The second part of VAWA 22 is the pilot project. You may have heard of the pilot project, and so I want to be very clear about what it is and what it means. In VAWA 2013, lower 48 tribes could go through a process with the U.S. Department of Justice in order to take criminal jurisdiction over non-Native people that committed certain crimes. And that certain crime in 2013 was domestic violence. In 2022, we have an expanded list of crimes. But again, they are focused on violent crimes, but now include violence towards children and others. This pilot project requires intention and effort, and it requires a strong partnership between the tribe and the federal government. The U.S. Attorney General is responsible for approving tribes who are interested in the pilot project. There's two main parts to think about when we think about the pilot project. You need an Indian tribe, and there is a list of federally recognized Indian tribes, and they need to be occupying a village. And that is a list, again, that is in ANCSA. And, you know, I don't want to call it a database, but we have a spreadsheet that we've put together that shows the list of tribes and the list of villages. And there's not 100% overlap because of some unique historical circumstances in certain areas. Some tribes that are federally recognized were not on the village list and vice versa. But those are the two main parts to focus on about where and who get to exercise this type of jurisdiction under VAWA 22. I alluded to the long process of the pilot project. And the pilot project and the process is mirrored on what happened in the lower 48. So tribes who assume or seek criminal jurisdiction over non-Native people who commit certain violent crimes within the village need to meet certain standards around protecting defendants' rights. So that is about providing public defenders. That is about providing law-trained judges. It does not require the judges to go to an ABA-accredited law school. It does require law-trained judges. It does require the ability to pull a jury that does not exclude a specific segment of the community. So all of those requirements are quite extensive. I'm not going to go into each one, but they are really designed to protect defendants' rights. And they certainly mirror the Western criminal system. It's certain crimes. As I mentioned at the beginning of VAWA, it was really focused on domestic violence. We now have an expanded list of crimes, in part recognizing that that definition of domestic violence that was in VAWA allowed some loopholes, most notably what was called the boyfriend loophole. If you didn't quite meet the definition of domestic violence, it was not something that the tribe could address in its own justice system. So VAWA 22 is designed to address those concerns as well. I'm going to stop talking, and I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Megan Topcock.
Through the chair, Megan Sirvana Topcock. Ulilotak, Atira Sirvana, Tanik Sinira Megan. Tapka koya rurunga, sinisorum yorunga, sequer mi rurunga, wanga staff attorney kowerk ink me. So good afternoon. Thank you for taking the time to listen to what we have to share with you all. I'm very appreciative. My English name is Megan. My Ipak name is Sirvana, named after my great uncle. And my family is the Topcocks from Teller and Mary Ziglu. And my family has lived on the lands of our ancestors for 10,000 plus years. I did grow up outside, but I'm very fortunate to have moved back to Nome and currently serve as the staff attorney at Kowerk. And I provide legal services to 19 tribes within the region. We do have 20 overall. The 20th tribe, Nome Eskimo, retains their own legal counsel and operates outside of our compact. So we partner with them as much as we can on these endeavors. But I like to just start off with an apology. I don't know why people keep putting a microphone in front of my face because I have a tendency to ramble. So I do have some notes up here that I will be looking at. So if I'm not making eye contact, I'm just nervous and I have to keep on track. Otherwise we will be here all night because I will keep talking. But I wanted to share some stories with you all, if that's all right. You've heard a lot of statistics, a lot of laws that have gone into effect and changed the history of colonization that Alaska Native people have experienced. But one thing that really stuck with me that was shared by a professor when I was in college is this quote, tell me the facts and I'll learn, tell me the truth and I'll believe, but tell me a story and it will live in my heart forever. So I just wanted to take a moment to kind of illustrate some of what my colleagues have been talking about and how it actually pans out in my region and in the work that I do. So I've been in my position for about 5 years, went to college and law school to do this work. It's all I ever want to do in life. I love it. It's hard, but it's hard work for me. And I grew up in a family where me and my family fit a lot of the statistics that you just saw. I grew up in a home with a lot of domestic violence, substance abuse. I was sexually assaulted in my early 20s in Nome, chose not to report because I had heard so many horror stories from my friends about what they had gone through when they reported and how they ultimately never got justice, and made a conscious decision at that point in my young life before I had gone to law school that I didn't want to put myself through that. And it was in part what spurred me to want to understand the legal systems and the unique legal landscape that we operate in within Alaska, and to work with tribes to bolster our own judicial system so that we can provide public safety to our people, which is something that we've done for thousands and thousands of years. So among other things I do, I also do election assistance, HR, but my real favorite is tribal justice development. And so all the tribes in my region have tribal courts, but they are active to varying degrees. Many have particular subject matters that they hear certain cases on. They tend to, as was noted earlier, favor doing child welfare cases. We care very much about our children, about our youth. We do a lot of domestic violence protective orders and juvenile justice related cases. So a decent chunk of the tribes in my region, I'd say about a third, have signed on formally MOUs with DJJ to have certain misdemeanor cases referred over to tribal courts to be handled. The remainder of cases that are eligible to be heard in tribal court, we route through the Nome Youth Court, which I also work with, so that we're able to have really strong partnerships with the tribes in the region. We typically handle those cases as circles, using circle peacemaking. We're very much a restorative justice-based approach to handling crime in our communities, recognizing that people make mistakes. There's a lot of trauma that our families have carried from boarding schools, from the impacts of colonization. A lot of the social issues that we're currently experiencing are the direct result of colonization. Domestic violence is not traditional. It is not something that we had in our communities before contact. And in fact, many of the stories, the oldest stories that we have, relate to how domestic violence is an inappropriate thing. So one story that we often kind of keep close to us as we're doing these domestic violence protective orders is the story of Sedna. She also goes by Nuliayuk and Sidrahina, and is the reason that women have our fingers tattooed. So we get these markings to honor what she went through. The reason that we do this is because she had her fingers chopped off. So she was a young woman, beautiful young woman, who was reluctant to get married. She had many suitors, but she kind of put all of them off until one day a very handsome young man showed up in the community. Can rate it because I had to come down to Southeast to find my husband and import him back up north because you're related to everybody. So she and this man get married and they move off and start their own home. They actually went out to a small island, and there's many variations of this story. This is just the one that I learned personally, but it's a story that's shared across the circumpolar north all the way to Greenland. And unfortunately, their relationship goes south very soon after. Turns out that he's a shapeshifter. He's very abusive and controlling. And she ends up becoming pregnant, and because he's a shapeshifter, a dog, they end up having puppies, and she doesn't want them to experience the abuse that she's experiencing, and so she puts them in her kamuk, her shoe, and pushes them off into the ocean, and they go on to inhabit other parts of the world, escaping that abuse. But she continues to be stuck. And so one day her father decides that he's going to go try to find his daughter because he hasn't heard from her in a long time and he's concerned. So he hops in his kayak and he's paddling out to the island. And it just so happens that her husband was out hunting. And so she's alone at home and she sees her father from a distance paddling out. And she's so desperate to escape the situation that she decides to jump in the water and start swimming out to him. And so she's swimming out and he's paddling his kayak. But all of a sudden the skies darken, the waves start white capping, the winds pick up, and it's because her husband's returning home and he sees what's happening. He doesn't want her to get away. So he shapeshifts into a raven and he's kind of pecking at the father, trying to deter him from rescuing his daughter. The father understandably freaks out because he's about to capsize. He's not going to survive. And he tells his daughter, look, I'm sorry, but I can't take you right now. You need to swim back to shore. I'll come back for you. And he's trying to turn around his kayak to go back to shore, but she's so desperate that she reaches up and she clings onto his kayak. Again, her father, fearing that both of them will lose their life in the storm and with her husband attacking, takes his paddle and he whacks at her hands. And the tips of her fingers come off, but she's still gripping onto the kayak because she's so desperate to get out of this situation. And he takes his paddle and he whacks again. And the next knuckle comes off. But she's still gripping, and so he whacks again, and her fingers come off. Finally, he whacks at her wrists, and her palms come off as well, and she sinks into the ocean. But from this, she sort of rises up and takes on this role of the caretaker of the underworld, of the seas, and her fingertips become the fish, her knuckles become the seal, the walrus, and her palms the whales. And so before this, we didn't have these animals to rely on for subsistence, for food, for cultural nourishment, but her circumstances, although tragic, brought this gift to us. And so she's the one who is responsible for taking care of those. She's also responsible for if we are harvesting inappropriately, wasting, mistreating animals, she will take those animals back into her hair at the bottom of the ocean. And we have to restore balance by sending one of our medicine people, a local, down to the bottom of the sea to sing to her and to comb her hair, to calm her, so that she'll release the animals back to us. And one other duty that she has is passing our souls on to the next life, into the afterlife. So that's why we get these markings as women, is so that we can secure passage, be born again into the next generation. And as a reminder to people in our community that women are sacred, that we have to take care of them, that they're the life givers, and that if we don't honor women, if we don't honor the land, the animals, Sedna is there to look out and take justice. So this is a story that I often keep in mind as we do these domestic violence protective orders. What I have found in the last couple of years that we started doing this, we did our first one shortly after the pandemic began. We had a situation in Wales where a young woman was in a really bad relationship. She was afraid to go into state court. And the tribal council came to me and was like, look, we have this situation. We're really worried about her. There's this abusive man in the community and they have no law enforcement. So only 5 of our villages currently out of 15 that surround Nome have a VPSO or any sort of law enforcement locally in the community. Otherwise, we're relying on the troopers to send somebody out, assuming the weather is even appropriate, to get a plane out. I mean, there was a time just a few weeks ago where we didn't even have Alaska Airlines jets flying into Nome because we had blizzard after blizzard rolling through. So it can be really difficult to rely on a post that is often understaffed, that is staffed by people who are typically not from our region, who may not understand these stories, understand our culture, our history, our values. And so the tribal council ultimately decided in this situation that they wanted to try to do something. Now, we didn't have a domestic violence code on the books, so I think I called up Rick and Alex, and I was like, oh my gosh, help. We're trying to deal with this situation. And we spent the whole weekend, my colleague and I, working with the Wales Tribal Council, putting a code on the books so that we could then hold these court proceedings to issue a protective order. So it was like a 20-page code that we put together. The council is majority elders. They're all more petite than I am, small little cute precious elders. And because there was no law enforcement and we were unable to get assistance as quickly as we needed to, or we felt that we needed to serve that protective order, it was actually the council themselves who literally linked arms and walked down to that dangerous individual's house to serve that protective order. And because of the conditions that we had placed in the protective order, he was unable to reside in the community. There was nowhere else for him to live without violating the conditions. He had to keep so many feet away from the victim. He ended up moving to another village in the region and unfortunately causing issues there. So it was kind of a temporary fix that solved an immediate problem, but eventually made that an issue in another community. But at least it gave the tribal council the ability to act quickly and to protect that woman. Again, it can be really hard to request a protective order in state court. We have judges who, again, aren't from here. Judge D. Benedetto is wonderful. I have nothing bad to say about him. But he didn't grow up in our region. He didn't grow up understanding the realities of what it is to live in a small village like Wales. And oftentimes, as judges are trying to ask questions to get the evidence that they need to issue a protective order, it may not always be understood by the person who's seeking that protection, the ways in which they need to answer those questions. So I do some pro bono work with ANDVSA to try to help people get protective orders. And a lot of what I do is simply translating the legalese to individuals so that we can show that there is cause to have a protective order issued. So there's simple things like that that tend to break down that cross-cultural communication piece. Also, we can do them much quicker in tribal court. And again, we have people who know that community, who know that family, their history, and people are just generally more comfortable. It's a less intimidating setting. When Mary Zigaloo and Teller did some protective orders, I went out to assist with them. And we set up a folding table, some folding chairs. There was, tiles on the floor that were missing because the multi-purpose building is so old and falling apart. But that's where we held court. And honestly, I think it's a lot less intimidating than having one judge sitting up on a dais who's looking down at you, who doesn't know you, compared to having your friends and family surrounding you and knowing that they're going to be there to take care of you no matter what, because we have to rely on each other to survive in the village. It takes a village. So we've had a lot of success, I think, in doing domestic violence protective orders. The only times where things tend to break down is when we ask for assistance from police departments or AST to help serve or enforce those orders. So even though they are entitled to full faith and credit, there just hasn't been enough training, I think, at this point for folks to understand that they need to be assisting tribes. When I first went to, we had a situation where a perpetrator was in Anchorage, and, we're an hour and a half flight from Anchorage. It's over $500 round trip. We also have no tribal police force currently to go out and even serve those. So I called up APD and requested, it was like, look, we have this protective order. We need it served on an individual who lives in Anchorage. Is this something that you can assist us with? We did this in compliance with the Violence Against Women Act. It's entitled to full faith and credit. And they were very unsure, which is understandable because it's something, we're such a unique state. We have a lot of unique issues that we're working through. And they thought that it was AST that was supposed to assist with that. And so they patched me over to AST and I talked to AST. And that trooper, for whatever reason, maybe I caught her on a bad day, but she laughed at me as if it was something that they, she was like, this isn't something that we do. Tribes can't do that. And I was really shocked, honestly. I had never faced something like that from someone before. And even though I have a law degree and have been doing this work, practicing law, took the bar exam, passed, I still have to deal with these people who don't believe that tribes are capable or legally allowed to do these sorts of things. And ultimately, we worked through it and we got the protective order served. But I worry that there are tribes out there who don't have attorneys like myself to advocate for them, who know the law and who can push back in situations like that. So what are they going to do if they face that resistance? It's not, they're not going to push it forward and be able to have that protective order served. So I do worry that there needs to be more training and understanding among our state law enforcement and state institutions about how tribes can partner. Because ultimately, we're trying to serve the same people, right? Our tribal citizens are also state citizens, they're municipal citizens, they're citizens of the United States. And when we work together, we're leveraging all that collective energy, power, funding to do what is needed in our communities. So I had mentioned earlier, I think the last story that I'll share, and I'm always happy to answer questions or clarify anything, but I had mentioned that we do the DJJ diversionary agreements. Those are honestly my favorite cases to handle, working with youth. And one circle that will always stand out to me, we had a couple young boys in one of our villages in the middle of the night during the summer, go by the VPSO's house and take his four-wheeler and go for a little joyride down to the beach. Of course, they get caught pretty quickly and are charged. Their case is sent through DJJ. It was referred over to the Nome Youth Court, and because I'm the director of the Nome Youth Court and also the tribe's attorney, I was able to kind of patch an agreement together where we were partnering with the tribe to handle the case. We actually went out to the village, and I took a couple of our youth court members who were local high school students. We worked with the tribe. The tribal council was very much wanting to be involved, very enthusiastic about it. And so I asked them, all right, I need you to identify who you'd like to participate. The council decided all seven of them would attend. They also invited the boys' grandparents, aunties, uncles, cousins, nieces, nephews. We show up, there's babies being passed around, and we're in the multi-purpose building, and the boys, of course, were there, and the VPSO was also very supportive of doing it with the tribe. He's a tribal member himself. He was unfortunately unable to make it because he was out moose hunting or caribou hunting or something that day, so he didn't attend, but gave his blessing, and I had talked with him previously about the situation. And so we come into the circle. We're all, you know, there's no table or anything in between us because we don't want to have any sort of block in between us. It's set up in a circle, and we lit a kulik, seal oil lamp, which is traditional for us because it signifies warmth in our homes, but also that connection to our ancestors. So the flames represent our ancestors coming into that space and providing support to us. And we went around and we talked about, you know, what happened, what was going on, why did you boys do that? And as we're going through the circle, it's probably 20, 25 people. Every single person in that space looked at those boys and said, look, we care about you. I love you. You're my grandson. You're my cousin. You're my niece, nephew, whatever. And we don't want you to get into trouble. What you did was not okay. That can't ever happen again. And we're going to figure out how to make it right. But ultimately, we care about you. And we don't want you to end up in the system. And one of the tribal council members himself had gotten into trouble with TJJ as a young man. He said, look, this was my experience. It was not good. I don't want this for you because I want you to succeed and I want you to take over my seat on tribal council someday. And you can't do that if you continue to get into trouble. And when we started that circle, the boys were obviously very tense, very anxious, very closed off. Their body language was very indicative of that. They were hunched over and not making eye contact. By the time 3-4 hours had gone by where we had been talking about all of this, they were sitting up, they were looking at people as they were talking, and their body language had completely changed. And as part of these circles, it's completely consensus-based. So we don't have a judge saying, all right, you messed up, and now you have to do X, Y, and Z to make it right. Those boys actually participated in determining how they would make it right. So they're taking accountability, and they're acknowledging that they have to do something to make it right. And they're making sure that we're sentencing them to something that they can actually do. So they had to haul elders' honey buckets and go fishing for the VPSO and, you know, go birding, egging, whatever it was for, I think we said they had to do 40 hours each because they had a trespass charge and then vehicle theft charges. And they had 3 months to complete it. We checked back in after 3 months. They had all completed their sentence. And, you know, this is over a year ago and I haven't heard a peep since. So knock on wood that we're all good there. But we've done a number of these circles in probably a third of the villages, and it's been incredible experience. I think not only for the community coming together, but individuals who are in those spaces, it's also very healing. I mean, I find myself getting very emotional and things of my own past come out, and it feels like we're able to come together and realize that we're not alone and that we all want the same goal. We want happy, healthy, thriving communities. And we recognize that we're the best position to ensure that that happens. So I'm very grateful to be able to do this work. We've also done a number of Rule 11 I, where we're able to provide sentencing recommendations to the state court judge on felonies or other misdemeanor level crimes that are not eligible to be referred over to tribal court. So we're trying to do our best to be involved with our tribal citizens to ensure that public safety is carried out in our communities. And hope to continue strengthening those relationships going forward. But again, I appreciate the time and listening to my stories and for all the work that you do as elected officials. Koyana.
Ms. Topcock, I first want to say I heard no rambling there whatsoever. And I mean this when I say this. All I heard was truth and power in what you just shared. That was incredible. I know... the most confident of us would struggle to speak to some of the very personal things that you did. And so I just want to thank you immensely for that testimony. You're giving me a little bit of allergies, as I like to call it, just sitting up here and hearing that. That's just incredibly powerful. So thank you very much for sharing that with us. You did not miss a beat. There is no rambling whatsoever. So thank you. Well, I think that has us at the end of our presentation now. Yes. Okay. So I guess then, you know, I mentioned at the beginning we would hold questions at the end. I'd like to open the floor for questions for any of our members. Everyone is still here. Does anyone have any questions? Representative Vance, is that a question or?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes. I have a variety of questions, but I'm trying to filter through. I have I feel like I need to there's obviously other technical questions that can be addressed later, but I think I need to ask a rhetorical question for the sake of all victims, and specifically sexual assault, human trafficking victims. I'm all about tribes taking responsibility, tribal sovereignty, and what I've heard. But part of the testimony that I just heard made it feel like the victim experience of a Native woman is exclusive in feeling the lack of justice, the difficulty in getting a protective order, not wanting to come forward because the feeling that law enforcement will not act, seeing what friends have gone through, and the trauma that incurs, the shame in the community, not being able to move forward, carrying that burden throughout your life. And I wonder why what I hear in this committee is that Alaska Native women feel that it's exclusive to your experience, because it sounds exactly what I have heard of white women in my community. It's the same thing. But what I continue to hear in this committee over and over again is if you're the only one. And I know that's not your heart, but I ask that when you come and present, that you remember that you have white sisters who are going through the same thing, and they don't feel they have justice either. It's all in presentation, but I'm not saying that there's clearly Alaska Native women have been abused at very high rates, but I can tell you there are innumerable white women who have the same internal experience of the trauma that Native women have expressed. The trauma is the same because of what has happened to them as an individual. Seeking justice is such an incredible struggle. And I feel conflicted in these conversations, and I don't want to be, because I want to seek justice for everyone, no matter what. And I know those are uncomfortable words. So I want to end it with a positive, and thanking you, all of you who have come and participated and being available, because just this morning I fielded a phone call of someone who had reached out, who was in the middle of a trafficking situation and had been turned away by agencies who could not help her. And the individual told me she sounds like a Native woman. And I said, well, I have some resources for you. And so I gave the number for the Alaska Native Resource Center, because right now the state of Alaska has no resources for her, but you potentially do. And I want to give recognition that you have been doing the work because of your federal partnership. You've made a way to help a woman where the state of Alaska has not yet. And I say yet because I'm working on that, because I don't want there to be a gap for anyone. I know there's an incredible gap for Alaska Native women, and I'm trying to meet that. But I'd like us to remember to be a little bit more inclusive when we're talking about the experience of trauma and seeking justice and healing, because It is something that so many women, regardless of color, are experiencing the same thing. And we have failed. We have failed to protect the innocent and the vulnerable in the state. And I'm hoping to change that. So thank you for being here and sharing your experiences.
Thank you, Representative Vance. I just want to say that I don't think by identifying the situations that we've heard throughout this committee necessarily negate the suffering of anyone else. I don't think it speaks. I don't think by them coming before us here that they're saying that it's. I'm sorry, I'm kind of at a loss for words right now. But I would like to invite our testifiers to come up if you would like to respond to anything that Rep. Vance just said. Representative Carrick.
Through the chair, I just wanted to say, Koyana, for those words. I wholeheartedly agree that this is not an issue that just affects Alaska Native women. And in sharing, I think, what I have and what I heard from my colleagues, you know, we can only share what our experience is as Alaska Native people or working in an Alaska Native serving organization. And I'm very grateful that there are people out there who are able to speak up for all women, for all of those who are innocent and vulnerable in our state who are not receiving the justice that they deserve. And so I appreciate your words and I recognize those and definitely stand in solidarity with everybody who is experiencing this. And I agree with Representative McCormick. It's certainly not intending to negate that others also have these experiences. And I think justice will ultimately be had by us standing together and recognizing that there are major gaps in public safety within the state that need to be addressed and should have been addressed years ago, frankly. So, Koyana.
Tammy Truitt-Giroux.
Thank you.
I've never turned anyone away, ever. No matter who they are or where they come from. But I also am passionate about access to services. And I realize that without access, there's not a choice. And that's the piece that we have some responsibility for, is that we can create an place where people have a choice to whether they report or get help or heal without judgment. And so I do appreciate you bringing that up. It's very difficult to say that. I understand that. Of course, my passion is that I'm working with Alaska Native victims, survivors, and I will continue to do that until they put me to rest somewhere. But the fact is that we stand in solidarity. And so I just wanted to go ahead and add that. Thank you.
Representative Carrick.
Thank you very much. Through the chair, I just wanted to first thank the speakers today. I also am actually kind of having a cold, but I had some allergies crop up with some of the information that was shared today. And I just want to say, you know, it, with all due respect to my colleague from Homer, I take some exception to the idea of this presentation excluding white women. As a white woman from urban Alaska, I can't say how much it hurts my heart to hear about the disparity. And while the suffering is the same for victims, the causes of that violence are not the same. And the response to that violence is not the same. And the justice for the victims is not the same. And until it's the same, we have got a lot of work to do. I've really appreciated the week we've spent on human trafficking last week, focusing on the problem across Alaska, and I really am appreciative that that was an effort that my colleague undertook. And I'm really appreciative this week that we've had an opportunity in this committee and in this building to focus on the disproportionate impacts of sexual assault and domestic violence for Alaska Native women, for women living in rural Alaska, for women living in urban Alaska on the road system. But particularly, I just want to say, as an ally to the individuals who have spoken today, that the suffering may be the same, but the problem is not the same. And it's really important that we recognize that before we go into how do we fix it. And so I hear what my colleague is saying, but I also just want to say, as a white woman, that I appreciate very much the presenters today. And I appreciate very much drawing attention to the disproportionate impacts. And I look forward to having a lot of continuing conversation about tribal sovereignty. Really encouraged to hear about the progress that's been made, but also the fact that it was 1991 before we began the process of tribal recognition, and it was 2022 before that actually took place in Alaska, I think is a huge testament to why we're at where we're at right now and how far we still have to go. So thank you to the chair for hosting this meeting today.
Thank you, Representative Carrick. Are there any further questions or comments from the committee? I want to thank you all very much for the presentation that you provided today and of course, throughout this week as well. I'd like to thank the Alaska Native Women's Resource Center, the Alaska Native Justice Center in Kuwerik for your presentation, but I think principally for the transformative work that you do for our rural communities. I cannot thank you enough for what you've done. I mean, Ms. Topcock, the story that you shared is so, so powerful. I cannot stress enough how important it is to have these spaces be of our community and not of, frankly, a courtroom and just the connotation there. And so, I want to thank you so much for that. The House Tribal Affairs Committee will meet again on Monday, February 12th. At 3:30 p.m., where we will be hearing from Joel Isaac, Tribal Liaison for DEED, on the State Tribal Education Compact Initiative Pilot Program. The time is 4:58 p.m., and this hearing of the House Tribal Affairs Committee is now adjourned.